Hey Retrospectors, for our third birthday, we've filmed an hour-long Q&A answering your questions.
We discuss our favourite facts, how we make the show, and what we've learned along the way.
If you're already supporting us on Patreon, thank you. You can watch it right now at patreon.com/retrospectors.
And if you're not a Patreon member, sign up. You don't have to pay a thing to become a free member and watch it now.
So check it out. It's free. patreon.com/retrospectors.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's May 2nd, 1611, and another remarkable event is about to be uncovered by Aria, Rebecca, and Ollie, the Retrospectors.
Thou shalt commit adultery. An unfortunate typo in the book published today in history in 1611, the King James Bible, which, apart from omitting that very important not, was otherwise a pretty much flawless delivery of the Holy Book in language accessible to common people.
The reason they wanted a new Bible was because there were officially sanctioned Bibles that had been written under Henry VIII, but they were kind of dry. Lay people who were able to read preferred the Geneva Bible, which had been written by Protestant scholars in exile in Geneva during the Catholic Mary I's reign. But the thing with the Geneva Bible was that the translation and, crucially, the footnotes promoted a very radically Calvinistic Protestant worldview. It was a favourite of Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans. This was considered a little bit spicy for James I. Also, Calvinism had an uncomfortable tendency to emphasize God over all human power, including kings. He wanted something that was a bit more moderate, but equally appealing.
And so it was for that reason that he surprised everyone by agreeing to the idea of a new Bible translation. A group of 47 scholars and theologians undertook this massive task of translating the Old Testament from Hebrew, the New Testament from Greek, and the Apocrypha from Greek and Latin sources. Much of their translation work was influenced by the earlier efforts of the Protestant reformer William Tyndale, and Tyndale had produced the first English translation of the New Testament from Greek in 1525, but was later executed for heresy. And when they released it in 1611, it was a hit. It quickly spread across Europe, and thanks to the massive resources poured into the project, it emerged as what was regarded as the most faithful and scholarly translation to date, as well as being the most accessible.
Well, you say it was a hit. We know from the ledger at Ely Cathedral that they didn't bother buying one for 2 years. They made an entry in the treasurer's account book in 1613, which simply says, "Item for a great Bible of the latter edition, 50 shillings. So there seems to be a great fervour and excitement to get hold of this text. But that might be because they had the Geneva Bible, as Rebecca was saying, and a lot of people were perfectly happy with the Geneva Bible. That was the one that Shakespeare had had. That was the one that the pilgrims had brought. It's just that it did translate king as tyrant numerous times. And so you can understand why some of the English gentry were torn.
Yeah, I mean, partly the story of the spread of the King James Bible was a technological one, because the advent of printing presses reduced the cost of copies massively compared to handwritten ones. Plus, translating it into English, which was the vernacular language, made it reachable for those literate in English and able to afford a printed Bible in the first place. And whereas before the Bible was really the sole property of the church, now it really became increasingly available for personal reading. And yes, a bit of this personal interpretation that is so very dangerous. But I think that one of the things that appealed about the King James Bible in particular was the departure from prior translations of its voice. It had this really poetic rhythm about it and vivid imagery, which led many people to perceive it as the very voice of God. They could hear God speaking in the way that this thing was being spoken to them.
Yeah, because it's not written in an English that actually was ever spoken. I think people look at it now and think, oh, that's how the Jacobeans must have gone about speaking, but it isn't. Mm. It's written in this elevated, you know, spiritual way. That is an attempt to translate, as you were saying earlier, Hebrew and Greek. So it's halfway between English and Hebrew and Greek. It's not a language all the thous and thouts and all of that stuff isn't what people sounded like, but it's what everyone understood. It adopted a new mode that was delivered orally and intended to be. So the punctuation in it is also based on breathing. It's intended to help someone read it aloud and literally sound like they are giving you God's commandments. That's the whole modus operandi that they used when the revising committee, as they were, gathered in the stationer's hall to draft the thing. They read the text out orally rather than interrogating the text on paper. And they knew that they were translators and not authors. They say in their preface that the earlier translators, quote, deserve to be had of us and of posterity in everlasting remembrance, that whatsoever is sound already, the same will shine as gold more brightly, being rubbed and polished. You know, they're rubbing and polishing the stuff that's there before because it's what God said.
Yeah, because one of the, you know, the main brief that he had from King James is that he wanted this Bible to unify people in a time of what was very intense theological strife. The goal was something that would take the edge off the popularity of the Geneva Bible, but wouldn't alienate Puritans or radical Protestants. And that lack of radical ambition is really evident in the preface. You know, they wrote, "We never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one." They were like, you know, everyone else who's tried has done a great job and we're not taking away from them. They also crucially didn't add in footnotes offering their theological interpretations, which is what had got previous translators into sticky situations. Most of their annotations were just alternative wordings or explanatory notes of things like biblical units of measurement. They tried very hard not to be radical. But yeah, as you mentioned, it was the quality of the language that did appeal to people from the beginning. And it's worth noting as well that although to us it just sounds old-timey, those forms of thee and thou and the verbs ending in uth, you know, they were already falling out of everyday use. So even to a contemporary listener, it would have sounded grand and old-fashioned and, you know, kind of awe-inspiring. And I think that language is one of the reasons that there is a weird myth that Shakespeare was somehow involved in the translation. But I think that's just from readers looking back and being like, wow, these old-timey things are both really well-written. You know, They actually don't have much in common linguistically.
But it's also true that the language in the King James can be either simple or complex as required by the original biblical text. So, for example, where the original text is rhetorically embellished, the King James Version is also. So, like in 1 Corinthians 13, you have a passage, "Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing." But on the other hand, it can be really simple and very beautiful, like in Luke 2:18, "And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flocks by night." Or from the creation story, Genesis 1:3, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." So it really goes from very high to very low.
It's also the secret of its success, I think, that James himself ushers in a new royal dynasty, but also crucially a new era of colonialism, particularly in North America. And that latter point is important because, you know, if you're only going to take one book with you when you go to build an empire, it's going to be this one, isn't it? It's endorsed by the king and it's about the most important thing to the fabric of your society. So guess what? The King James Bible went wherever the English went. Mm. And actually, you know, you were talking about technology being the crucial kind of delivery mechanic for it. Yes, but also kind of imperialism, right? I mean, it's because the whole world met the English and met their Bible with them.
Yeah, and not only did the Bible itself go all over the world, the idioms that it created went all over the world as well. I mean, there's lots of phrases and passages in the Bible that we recognize as being vaguely biblical in origin. You know, "Seek and ye shall find," "My brother's keeper," "How are the mighty fallen?" Those are all from the King James Bible. But also so many common expressions that aren't necessarily associated with the Bible or religion at all. A few of these that originate in this Bible: "A fly in the ointment," "Stumbling block," "By the skin of my teeth," "To some suffer fools gladly," "The blind leading the blind," "A drop in the bucket," "From strength to strength," and "Seeing the writing on the wall."
Yeah. But also thinking about the motivation for what King James was trying to do. You know, in England, he really couldn't stop the trouble that was brewing, the bitter religious disputes that had motivated this Bible translation in the first place eventually spiraled, and by the 1640s, it turned into the English Civil Wars, which ended in the capture and execution of King James's son, successor, Charles I. So if James had hoped that he was going to quash any doubt of his and his successor's divine right to power, he clearly hadn't succeeded. And I suppose that's because the King James Bible keeps in it the sense of what was being communicated by the original biblical texts, and that was that no person is greater than God. And once this message was in the hands of everyday folk, then they could interpret that as revolutionarily as they intended.
Yeah, but I mean, it was an incredible success from the point of view of it becoming the definitive Bible regardless, though, right? Whatever happened to England, never mind King James personally. Like, if you're choosing a verse to represent what Christian language sounds like when you read it out in a church, feel like you're going to still choose the King James Bible. I think even James himself would be astonished.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nothing spells success like having been quoted in both Handel's Messiah and Coolio's Gangster's Paradise.
Tomorrow.
Once that was out of the box, you know, welcome to Spam Town.
Ditch the ads and get a Sunday episode when you join Club Retrospectors. Patreon.com/retrospectors.